But Ian, I hand over to Ian now, who must be known to most of you. He's done so much to improve the quality of research in this country and give the medical research.
Do you have the right kind of digit that can get my
without
a mouse? I'm pretty ten. Pathetic.
Let us see. I apparently do. Are you on the desktop?
Yeah, that one there.
This one here.
Yeah. Thanks very much.
Voila.
Many thanks. Well, first of all, I want to thank Mary and Richard for inviting me here, but I want to say straight away that these two first presentations bring joy to my heart. I guess particularly Mary's, because I've been writing about this for 30 years next year. And I found it just wonderful that there are social scientists who are beginning to take this issue more seriously than they have done in the past. Ray referred to bureaucracy. I downloaded the 157 pages of the National Patient Safety Agency's Central Office for Research and Ethics Committee's documents about information sheets and consent forms, guidance for researchers and reviewers. People have talked about the need for bureaucracy busting. I want to just mention that as government is talking about bureaucracy busting, I'm concerned that what has motivated it actually is the interests of industry. I have heard people in research governance departments saying, if you're dealing with an application to approve an industry trial, it should be preferred over and above publicly funded trials and charitably funded trials. And I find that a really serious and worrying concern. The fact that we have not dealt with this issue, as it were, on its own merits, and not until industry's interests come into play, is very sad indeed. The other thing I want to say by way of introduction is I want to explain how I come to this. I come to this as an ex-clinician who realized that with the best of intentions, it was possible to harm and sometimes kill one's patients. And that experience as a clinician basically induced, up till now anyway, a lifelong obsession with better evaluation of the effects of treatments. So let me try and take you through what I'm going to talk about, but I'm going to start to be clear about what I'm not going to talk about. I'm not going to refer to the examples discussed by Beecher and Papworth and many others since, and for example, Susan Lederer's latest book. And to use Beecher's classification, I'm not talking about consent for known effective treatment to be withheld. Tuskegee is an example, but there are numerous current examples of that. Physiological studies, like the one that killed Ellen Roche in Johns Hopkins in 2001. Studies to improve understanding of disease, such as the Willowbrook scandal. Technical, usually invasive studies of disease, such as that reported in 1961 by Samet, Bernstein, and Litvak, which involved putting probes through the back of individuals into their hearts. And first-in-human studies of potential therapies, like the one that killed Jesse Gelsinger, and like TGN 1412 in Northwick Park earlier this year. So I'm not going to talk about those things. The double standards to which I wish to refer concern informed consent to treatment already in use within normal or routine clinical practice. And I'm not going to try and define those because that's precisely the issue which Mary rightly left hanging, because that's where there does need to be a discussion. The issue is this. Richard Smithells, a British paediatrician, said it all by saying, I need permission to give a drug to half my patients, but not to give it to them all. In other words, I need permission to give a drug to some patients, but not to others, to find out what the effects of the drug are. But if I want to give it to all of them, I don't need permission for that. Double standards applied to treatment given within and out with formal efforts to assess the effects of treatments have been recognized for at least 200 years. Here's Charles MacLean in 1818. Charles MacLean thought that mercury was good for a whole lot of things which other people didn't think it was good for. But not everyone, other people agreed with him. And so he did some studies to try and make it clearer where the role of mercury might be. And he was criticized by colleagues. And he said, confident of an easy victory, if these other people were right, they would abstain from applying the very means which they are so strenuous to condemn. This proposition could only be evaded by pretending a reluctance to try experiments with the lives of men, as if it were not manifest that my experiments, which were always first tried upon myself, were capable of being conducted with perfect safety, or as if the practice of medicine in its conjectural state were anything else than a continued series of experiments upon the lives of our fellow creatures. A better known quotation comes from Claude Bernard. Later that century, many physicians attack experimentation, believing that medicine should be a science of observation, but physicians make therapeutic experimentation daily on their patients, so this inconsistency cannot stand careful thought. Medicine, by its nature, is an experimental science, but it must apply the experimental method systematically. I first got into this business in harness with Bill Silverman, a wonderful, now deceased pediatrician in the United States, who has made people anyway within pediatrics think much more carefully than perhaps they would have done without his prompting. And I know that for both Hazel Thornton and myself, he was a fantastic inspiration. And then in this article, published 20 years ago on these double standards, here's a quote. There's another more pervasive way in which double standards operate to promote poorly controlled experiments on uninformed patients. Illogically, and with no empirical evidence to support it, a mischievous view has been promoted that the interests of the vast number of patients involved in the poorly controlled experiments of informal medical tinkering are less in need of protection than are those of the relatively small number of patients who are involved in planned, properly controlled clinical experiments. This is the sort of public image that is presented about people involved in controlled clinical trials, for example. And if one looks for evidence relating to the relative risks of people involved in randomized controlled trials compared to similar patients receiving similar interventions who don't participate, I won't read this all out. There is no evidence that there is a greater risk associated with receiving treatment within the context of a randomized controlled trial. Now, I actually used to say, on the basis of previous evidence, that you were actually better off being involved in a controlled trial. I've changed my position on that because I believe this is now the best evidence, and it's available to anyone through the Cochrane Library, the National Library for Health. You can get it and have a look at it if you want. So when Richard, in what I consider a landmark editorial in the BMJ, pointed out that for ethical as well as scientific reasons, when there's properly informed uncertainty about the relative merits of alternative treatments, the trial is the treatment. That is how you do right by the patient in front of you. Or anyway, that is, I'm not talking about future patients now. I'm talking about doing right about the patient in front of you, and I'll come back to that. John Lantos has referred to this situation in an article in 1994. He's an American pediatrician, but also, I'd say, a medical ethicist as well. Would that be right, Ray? He referred to it as a confused ethical analysis. And I think it probably has reflected Maurice Papworth's influence. If you look at the difference between the American comments and Maurice Papworth's comments, I'm trying to remember the guy who's quoting Beecher's comments and Maurice Papworth's, you had that classification by type of experiment in Beecher's paper. Maurice Papworth was more concerned with the categories of individuals who were vulnerable. And so He had a far greater emphasis on consent than Beecher did in his writings. In fact, it was clear from comments made by John Bunker in this book on Beecher's paper that Beecher himself had not been particularly diligent about seeking consent to control trials which didn't involve the unacceptable practices which he had identified in his article. So when in 1978 Maurice Papworth wrote quite a long article actually about medical ethical committees, I've stopped calling them ethical for a long time because I believe they're fundamentally unethical in the way that they operate at the moment, he was influencing the way that research ethics committees grew up in this country. And I wrote a response, these are the first and last paragraphs of it, first of all saying that I shared many of his concerns about medical experimentation, but that I wasn't so sure that the medical world can be neatly divided into clinical experimenters, the bad guys, and altruistic clinicians, the good guys. And what I then went on to do was to offer an example, which was the use of the drug diethylstilbestrol in pregnancy. Now, we came to know that diethylstilbestrol actually causes cancers in the daughters of women who received it during pregnancy, and indeed other abnormalities both in their daughters and in their sons, genital abnormalities, and indeed in the mothers themselves. The latest evidence suggests that those mothers who received diethylstilbestrol during pregnancy are at greater risk of breast cancer. Now, I said that there were some people who did controlled trials of diethylstilbestrol, and I would not be in the least bit, and they were done in the early 50s, basically. And the MRC actually did one, and I wouldn't be in the least bit surprised if the people participating in those trials were not asked whether they would participate in those trials. The trials failed to find any evidence that diethylstilbestrol was good for anything. It was meant to prevent miscarriage and stillbirth and all sorts of things. So I asked Dr. Papworth in this letter, were the doctors who did those trials and then gave up using this drug as a consequence of finding no support for its use, behaving more or less ethically than doctors who continued to use it for 30 years without any evidence that it was useful? With the consequence, I mean, it's been estimated, I think, that in the United States alone, 3 million women were given this drug. Which group of doctors were behaving more ethically? So I say at the end of that thing, it seems very possible that there's a more urgent need to protect patients from the uncontrolled experimentation which characterizes much accepted medical practice by altruistic but scientifically uncritical clinicians. Certainly, the number of patients at risk is much larger than those whose interests are protected to a greater or less extent by ethical committees. I was still using the adjective there. So that's why I say I've been wittering on about this topic for nearly 30 years, next year. He published another article in 1990 in the BMJ giving a history of human guinea pigs. And I said there in a longer letter, 13 years ago, prompted by an article published by Dr. Papworth in which he used the words experiment and experimentation, I tried to encourage him to clarify what he meant by these words. Because he didn't respond to my questions at that time, and because he uses these words in his more recent article, I'd like to invite him again to make his position clearer. Then I gave the diethylstilbestrol example. The specific example is unimportant, but the general issue that it illustrates is one in which one which many medical ethicists seem unwilling to confront straightforwardly. Influential commentators on medical ethics like Dr. Papworth owe it to those of us who have been asking them to justify their apparent double standards for more than a decade to explain their position more clearly. He didn't respond. Now, I've wittered on, as I've said, not just in talks about this issue for a long time, but frankly there are only three of these publications that I would say are important. Most of them are blasts of frustration that this issue of double standards is being ignored. And they were both published in 2001, and I won't be publishing anything further on this issue because, having heard what Mary had to say in particular The thing is now being discussed. It's at last being addressed. But I, together with Richard Lindley, a neurologist, contributed a chapter to this book on informed consent. And I'm not going to quote from the book, because our chapter, because that's in essence what I'm talking about. But I want to read Len Doyle's commentary on it at the end of the book. This chapter highlights another problem with Gillen's argument. Ray Gillen had an earlier review by Len. With great panache, he says, Chalmers and Lindley argue that too much of the discussion about the ethics of medical research has overly emphasized its risks at the expense of playing down the risks of standard therapy. They demonstrate that such therapy is often without a rigorous scientific base and that it may well pose greater risks. Further, they marshal convincing evidence to show that participation in trials may reduce risks and provides more benefit than relying on standard unassessed therapies. I've now, in the light of more recent data, changed that position to a neutral statement. Consequently, a more balanced ethical analysis of informed consent in medical research would make these points. I completely concur with this view, and I hope that it will have significant impact on future debates that it deserves to. I'll take the author's arguments more into account in my own writing on the subject in future. Now, he went on to say, what the trouble with Chalmers and Lindley is they don't say what the single standard should be. And I'm not going to try to do that here. That is precisely what needs to be discussed, and certainly not put up as a cockshy by an ex-clinician and a neurologist. The other thing published in 2001 was a satirical paper, which is, I think, one of the most important papers I've ever co-authored. And by the way, I can make available copies of these things to anyone who is interested to read them. And what we tried to do, Andy Oxman, Dave Sackett, myself, was to show this double standard by lampooning it, by referring to different types of consent for different types of purposes. And we ended the interactive, personalized approach to informed consent to give some indication of the kind of process of consent to treatment which we felt was appropriate. It's difficult to read this, but it was a cartoon associated with the article done by the BMJ, and you've got this Janus-type doctor in the middle. It reflects very much on both Ray's and Mary's talk. In normal practice, with a smile and a smiling patient, here's a prescription for Zapit, Mrs. Jones, Ms. Jones, beg your pardon, let me know if you have any troubles. But then, alternatively, in the other side of the Janus type face, with both the doctor and the patient looking miserable, Zapit is a drug that's been used for many decades, Ms. Jones. We believe it might be useful for what ails you, but we're not certain. Therefore, we're conducting a randomized trial. If you want to be a guinea pig in this trial, you need to read this 126-page informed consent form that includes a list of 128 possible side effects. You will also need to sign a legal contract to protect me, the investigators, the manufacturers of Zapit, the stockholders, and our ethics committee from lawsuits should any untoward thing happen on the way. It was a... I'm just sorry the reproduction hasn't come out better, but it just said it all. So these are the sort of things that a single standard for informed consent to treatment would require all patients to be told the rationale for selecting the treatments offered to them. The more of these operations that I do, the more I earn. I've stock in the company that makes this drug. My institution has a massive grant from the company that makes this equipment. This drug was highly recommended at a sponsored symposium in Tenerife last month. I was told at medical school 30 years ago that this treatment was the best available. Or a systematic review of the evidence leaves me uncertain which of the possible alternative treatments is going to be best for you. And this is not just someone coming from within the biomedical research community. This has got into the New Yorker. The legend here is, try this, I just bought 100 shares. So this is a real issue which is beginning to be seen by the public, particularly as this commercialization of academia as a whole has continued apace. Governments tell universities they've got to be businesses. Universities tell departments they've got to be businesses. Departments tell individual researchers they've got to be businesses. And I think it is an absolutely disgusting and perverse development, which is actually resulting in the loss of some very, very important social values and, indeed, I would say, advances in treatment. So I want to bring it down personally now, because I referred to the patient in front of you before. What do I want as a patient? I've written about this. I wrote about it a long time ago. First of all, I want systematic reviews of carefully controlled research to produce the kind of evidence that I'm likely to believe and that I would wish those offering me care to take into account. And the reason for that is because that work has not been done, some life-saving treatments have been delayed for more than a decade, while other treatments have been recommended long after controlled research has shown them to be harmful. And that's why I go back to saying that withholding effective treatment is still a very big problem today. And ethics committees are presiding over that. I can show you data should we need that in the discussion. But my second wish is that when the relative merits of alternative forms of care are uncertain, I want to be offered the opportunity to participate in properly controlled research. And I've got a card which actually makes that clear in case I'm semi-conscious. Now, is that altruism or self-interest? It's pure self-interest. Patients receiving treatment as participants in some trials seem to fare better, now I've modified that in the 12 years since then, than apparently comparable patients receiving the same treatments outside trials. Furthermore, new technologies, and this has now been firmed up indeed, seem as likely to be inferior as they are to be superior to existing alternatives. So randomization provides an efficient hedging strategy in the face of these evenly balanced odds. And thirdly, randomized controlled trials help to generate reliable information on which to base future decisions about my health care. I've been trying to find out how to prevent recurrent tennis elbow. It's a bloody nuisance when it comes. But are there any trials looking at that? No, there aren't. There's no money in it. But the point is, I think one of the things that really has to be thought about is what are the interests of patients who participate in controlled trials? Not what it might do for knowledge in general or science and whatnot. Because having thought about this, that's my starting place. And I'm not suggesting everyone will take the same position as me, but at least it deserves some attention from ethicists, which it never has, as far as I know. This is a Lancet editorial which sums it up. The clinician who's convinced that a certain treatment works will almost never find an ethicist in his path, whereas his colleague who wonders and doubts and wants to learn will stumble over piles of them. So, I believe actually that the bioethics community has jeopardized my interest as a patient by acquiescing in research which has not been based on systematic reviews of existing evidence. It's acquiesced in biased underreporting of research, and that is a continuing disgrace, and it has encouraged double standards on informed consent to treatment. Again, a long time ago, more than 10 years ago, Julian Sevelescu, an ethicist, myself, and Jennifer Blunt, the chair of a very large research ethics committee, published an article in which we illustrated some ways in which we felt research ethics committees were behaving unethically. The results of recent empirical investigations imply that research ethics committees, by endorsing new research which is unnecessary and by acquiescing in biased underreporting of research which they've approved. As far as I know, no one's taken a blind bit of interest of that. However, they have taken an interest within the bioethics community of a paper I published a long time ago suggesting that underreporting research is scientific misconduct. And someone drew to my attention that this had been selected for republication in this sort of compendium of readings for people interested in ethical and regulatory aspects of clinical research. But I still get provoked from time to time. This one was in The Lancet in 2003, and I end by two ethicists writing from Cambridge, and ended it by saying, just as I resent the arrogance of health professionals who assume without reliable empirical evidence that they're doing right by their patients, so do I resent the arrogance of bioethicists who, confident that they occupy higher moral ground than ordinary mortals, do not assess the consequences in practice of their prescriptions and proscriptions for other people. Luckily, I had the opportunity of working with Imogen Evans and Hazel Thornton, who are both here today, and somewhat less confrontational way of dealing with this issue was urged on me by these two very thoughtful people. But one thing we did come out with was a different way of seeing what the responsibilities to patients were. It wasn't about looking through 157 pages worth of finding out how to write a consent form. And we, this book was written for the public, we advised people to participate in a clinical trial only on condition that the study protocol has been registered publicly, that the protocol refers to the systematic reviews of existing evidence showing that the trial is justified, and that you receive a written assurance that the full study results will be published and sent to all participants who indicate that they wish to receive them, because some of the empirical research has shown that people don't want that. So I thank very sincerely indeed Mary and Richard and the few medical ethicists who have drawn attention to the confused ethical analysis reflected in these double standards on informed consent to treatment, and to them and to others, like Ray, for example, who've called for a more thoughtful ethical analysis informed by empirical research. That's the thing that's been completely lacking, or not completely, but it's been too lacking in all of this, to assess the consequences of, I would call them, ethics interventions in the lives of others. And I'm going to end by quoting from one such ethicist, who's not here today, I'm sad that he's not, Tony Hope, who published this very nice little book called A Very Short Introduction to Medical Ethics. It's great. It's made me think in all sorts of ways that I had in areas that I hadn't thought about. So let me just end by reading this. It's a bit small on the screen. Why should risk of harm be more carefully controlled and more restrictive in the context of medical research than it is in other areas of our lives? We don't prevent the sale or purchase of skis, motorbikes, or hang gliders, although these expose purchasers to moderate risks. Why should the control of medical research be different? This is only one example where the regulation of medical research imposes standards that seem out of keeping with other areas of life. Another example is with regard to the amount of information provided to patients who are being asked to take part in a clinical trial. And then he gives two contrasting examples, a bit the same way that Mary did in her talk, of treatment being offered in, if you like, usual clinical practice in an area of uncertainty as compared to research. And he said, in the research case, the guidelines and research ethics committees require Dr. A to inform B, that's the patient, about both drugs and about the method of choosing which to prescribe. In the clinical case, this standard of informing is not the norm. Is this difference justified? If it is, then the standards are simply different. If it is not, we're operating double standards, that is, standards that are different and where the difference is not justifiable. Double standards are an example of inconsistency. They tell us that at least one of the standards needs to be changed, or perhaps both, actually. But I leave you there with, and this is why I'm heartened by these developments. I can go away and shut up now, after 30 years of wittering on about this, because there are people who will be respected to a great extent than I'm likely to be, because they are saying these sort of things now. Thank you very much.
Good. Well, we have...